are listening to IDEA, the podcast about improving data engagement and advocacy. I'm Brianna Wham.
And I'm Shannon Sheridan. In our episodes, we'll be bringing you interviews from real-world data professionals who are engaging their researchers in new and novel ways.
We'll also be reviewing the literature and keeping you up to date on what's getting published that's worth a read, or in your case, a listen.
We hope you'll join us as we talk with our colleagues and see what's working, or what's not, in the wider world of research data management.
We've spent a lot of time on the show so far talking about how data professionals engage with researchers. That's, you know, the premise of the show. But one of the things that can really impact how that happens, whether it's how frequent, how long someone gets to work on that engagement, whether there's even opportunity for engagement, is based on how a data professional's institution has modeled their support services. Engaging with researchers as part of an embedded data management team, for example, is much different than a solo data librarian. And so this month, during our article review, we're looking at a paper that kind of delves into what the different data management support services look like at different institutions.
So yes, as Shannon mentioned, today we're going to be looking at a report out of the Research Data Alliance titled Professionalizing Data Stewardship, Current Models of Data Stewardship Survey Report. And this report is authored by Bill Ayers, Lisa Letsalu, Graham Parton, Adam Zaldobagi, Eleanor Warren, Angus White, Nicholas Zimmer, and the Professionalizing Data Stewardship Interest Group. And we will be providing access to the DOI in our show notes for this. This is a really substantial report that really gets at exactly what Shannon was saying, is how can these roles, these data professionals, engage with researchers? How has that been done? What are the factors influencing it? And what's working and what's not?
And so, like we do with every article review, here's a few notes about why we chose this article. The first being that, as we've mentioned once or twice already, is that it's actually a survey report, not a traditional journal article. And because it is a comprehensive survey report for the survey that the interest group put out as part of their work, it's really long. Like, the whole document's about 50 pages. And I don't know about you. I mean, I guess for the content of this podcast, I did go through and read all 50 pages, and Brianna did too. But generally in the day-to-day, that's not going to be something that you have the time or inclination, understandably, to sit down and read. But there's still a lot of good content in it, so we wanted to make sure that we could actually distill that for you with a couple of good takeaways. The other reason that we highlighted this one was that because it's not a traditional journal article, instead it's a Research Data Alliance output, it means you're not super likely to come across it if you're keeping an eye on just journals, or maybe you've got search alerts set to keep you up to date on the literature that's getting published, because it really is available only on Zenodo and through the RDA website. And then finally, it really is just an interesting read to see how other institutions are thinking about and structuring their RDM support that allows them to do the work of engaging with researchers. And I know for me personally, and I'm sure for plenty of you, it can be quite useful to compare across institutions, whether they're the same kind of institution or perhaps they're different in their size or scope, to see what the trends might be and where you can take away information that could help you with your own support services.
Yeah, and Shannon, I think that's a great ending point as to why we kind of selected this article, is really because it's a survey report, they're presenting those results, allowing you to interpret what that means based off of your own institution, what you're seeing reflected from other institutions, and extrapolate from it what you need and what can benefit either you as a data professional or the data services that you're offering at your institution.
Yeah, and Brianna, I know we were talking about this as we were going over our notes, but that does mean that there's not a ton of analysis into this data. It's very much top level. Here's what we found. Here's what the report said. So all of the chit-chatting and discussing of the results are very much going to be yours and my interpretations of this data. Someone else may look at the data and may have an entirely different takeaway depending on the institution and the work that they're doing.
Exactly. I think that's a great point. And so looking at that, what were they really trying to do? What was their goal in presenting this survey? So They mentioned that their goal was to engage with global research data management community to capture information about the approaches that organizations are taking to data stewardship. They wanted to gain insight into how services deploy staff roles and resources to practice and employ data stewardship in a way that meets the needs of stakeholders and the targeted research community's requirements. And so within this goal, I think it's interesting that it's that global perspective. So I think we're going to discuss some of this a bit later, but they are really looking at different scales, different organization types, different roles, as well as trying to gain insight from how do those differ, how are they similar, and what does that mean if you're trying to interpret this or develop this at your own institution?
And they did provide a couple of caveats at the beginning of the report in terms of what the data showed them. It is pretty Eurocentric in terms of the respondents because they were reliant on people voluntarily replying to their survey. So something like 76% of the institutions that replied were based in Europe, but North America did have a respectable showing of about 14%. And I think the remaining, and I'm going to do math slash try to remember what the percentage was, but I think like the remaining 14% or however much would have been left was then spread across the rest of the globe. So Asia, Africa, Australia took up the rest of the survey responses. And then the really nice thing, I will say, if you are interested in seeing what all of their results were, they did do a nice two-page kind of executive summary that listed out all of the major takeaways for the different questions that they asked throughout the survey. But they also did spend time diving into each particular question and pulling out the data so that you could literally see all of it.
Yeah. And so starting to kind of get into kind of some thoughts and reactions to this survey and the results presented, one of the things that I thought was actually really unique about this survey that you don't see frequently is, and can actually be useful in assessing how to interpret these results for your own use case, institution, organization, was their approach to compare service provider types on two levels. So the first level that they're looking at was organizational levels. So by that, they mean, is data stewardship happening at the project level, department level, multi-departmental, institutional, multi-institutional, national, multinational, or global? They had a lot of categories there, but it really breaks it down. So you can see where do you sit within that organizational level and how does it differ? They also, interestingly, looked at domain specificity. So are the services being provided general agnostic, multi-domain, single domain, or subdomain? So how discipline specific is the support that's being provided by that organization or institution? And most of the questions that they asked, the results are actually broken down based on one or both of these organizational categories. And I think this is what's really interesting because it allows you to see where there's differences and where there's similarities. And if that organizational level or that domain specificity really drives any part or aspect of the data stewardship service. So for instance, looking at service offerings at these levels, they found, potentially not unsurprisingly, that decentralized services were often associated with generic multi-domain services, but were spread across all organizational levels, where things like federated services are typically only occurring at national to international levels. The other place that I found it really interesting, actually, to look at these differences by organizational levels or domain specificities is when it comes to job roles. I thought it was interesting, though again, potentially you would see this coming, is that things like data stewards and librarians typically found at the institutional, departmental, or project levels, whereas jobs like engineers, developers, data scientists, or managerial roles were often found at those higher level organizations. And so they suggest that this distinction could reflect the service offerings themselves, but I would also be interested to see how these job titles might also be impacting candidate pools that are applying to those jobs.
It would also be interesting to see like job descriptions and salary and what those would look like between the two, because I mean, to me, looking at that, engineer definitely says higher job salary than maybe data librarian would. But I wonder how much of that is reflective in like the different job duties versus just the kind of organization that they're in. What do you think?
I was thinking the same thing, because I do think that those different types of job titles are going to attract different candidate pools, probably based off of what you're saying. Exactly, they probably do have distinctions potentially written into those job ads or into the salary that's being offered. And so I do think that's an interesting thing. And I want to say that at a previous plenary, this interest group was looking at various job profiles and collecting what those look like. So it'd be interesting to see if that's out there and see if we can kind of see that comparison. And it's probably potentially in their data as well, something to explore further.
Yeah, I do know there was a report, I think it was North American based though, that analyzed job descriptions for data librarians a couple years ago. If we can find it, we'll pop the DOI also into the show notes. But it also makes me wonder too, because I know since it was European centric and they tend to be a little bit further ahead in data management support nationally, I would say, than the US. You know, the fact that a lot of those larger national institutions are probably doing more intensive data work that it might, and more specialized, that maybe that would be an instance where there is a lot more specificity or a lot more specialization maybe in those job descriptions. And of course, that also might have to be tied to their funding model, you know, where the money comes from could have an impact. And that's something that always now interests me because of the way that PNNL, where I work, is structured. So for data services here, we function as a service center and we basically have to charge projects time for what we work on. And this is standard across our lab. So if you go to copy editing or if you, you know, have to work with research computing, it's kind of that everybody knows that you're probably going to be charged depending on what help you need. But I know that's not standard at a lot of institutions across the US. And they actually asked a question about the funding model for different institutions for the different stewardship models. And now this was a little bit trickier to analyze in terms of the data because people could select multiple options. So you could say that you had like a dedicated budget, but then you also received project funding, which makes sense. You know, sometimes it's partially dedicated and then you have to make up the rest with project money. That's actually kind of how our library works. But looking at the data, nearly half of the institutions had a dedicated recurring budget, which is really nice because I think that shows that institutions recognize that this is work that is worthy of having a dedicated budget. Then in second and third, they had a fixed term budget for a specific service and then direct cost, like my institution. So that was second and third respectively. But one really interesting thing that they point out is that nearly a third of respondents said that volunteer effort is important for services. And in fact, 7 of the 19 services who selected volunteers as an option were entirely reliant on it. And what I would love to understand is what exactly was meant by volunteer. Does that mean that people are doing it even if it's not strictly in their job description? So maybe they're a science librarian who also does data stuff on the side, or maybe it's only when it is in their job description and they aren't getting additional funding for things like storage or deposit. So maybe you're a data librarian, but you have to pay extra for other services. They didn't quite answer that. And I have a feeling it probably has slightly different definitions for everybody who selected volunteer. But I did think that was a really interesting data point. And funding, I think, is really interesting in general, because I think it can really impact how data professionals can engage with their audiences. You know, the types of interactions you're going to have as someone who is just getting to do this as part of their job is going to be a lot different than someone who has to convince you to part with money to take advantage of your services.
Yeah, and I think it's a really timely result to be looking at, especially at least here in the US, we have numerous new policies going into effect around data management and sharing that actually allow researchers to budget for those practices. And I know, at least at my institution, there's been a lot of discussion around, well, how are we offering our services? Is there anything that should be, as you have at PNNL, kind of charged for? Is it still something, or is there a certain extent of services we offer for free? And then if it's above that, there is a charge, and how to handle that? Because we have researchers that are coming in saying, our budgets are too tight, we have no funding. Well, we also have researchers coming in saying, I would love to hire a data manager. Do you have anybody that I can put onto my budget for my research project?
Yeah, and it's not that money is not sexy, but it's kind of not, because at the end of the day, it is just budgetary stuff. And so sometimes I feel like we don't talk about it quite as much as we could. when it comes to figuring out how to price things out, where to be charging people, and what that looks like in the greater scheme of federal requirements, national requirements, whatever requirements you're working in.
Yeah. And I think it's an important aspect to think of as service development matures and goes along as what makes the most sense.
Yeah.
I also thought looking at this and their survey results, again, interesting but not unsurprising. It was interesting to see responses to three of their questions that actually reflected each other. So they asked a question about factors that influenced engagement with research data producers, factors that increased adoption of the services themselves by users, and barriers to those services themselves. And what was interesting here is that first question about factors that influence engagement was open-ended, and they found four themes. The themes that came out were policy compliance, resourcing for support, scope of support offered, and visibility, outreach, trust, and embedding in the research practice. When looking at the factors that increased adoption of those services, we similarly saw that the highest response rates seemed to match those open-ended responses provided. So things like there need to be buy-in from senior management to see enough value in these data stewardships to promote the resource. Awareness of and ready access to skills and knowledge for data stewards, and uptake of tools and services to help produce outputs. And also then exemplars from these communities. So seeing that it's working, that there's support for it. And lastly, also then, again, requirements from publishers and funders for availability of data. And then looking at this from another angle, those barriers, and this is potentially getting a little confusing as I'm breaking this down, but I think the main point is looking at the barriers, it was lack of buy-in, stakeholders' attitudes, and lack of incentive. And so these things really go hand in hand. You need to have buy-in from senior management supporting the service. So I think that kind of came from what you were talking about, is that it was actually really great to see funding, this kind of centralized funding for these services, because it shows there's buy-in and understanding that there's value for this. And potentially that could grow. And then also you need to have the stakeholders themselves have an interest in actually improving their data management, and have the service providers have the skill set necessary. And so that's an interesting thing. And I think, I know we talk a lot about here that idea of incentive and how do you incentivize researchers to do this? You have both these policy requirements coming down, but also how do we actually also enable reward structures in the settings that they're already working on? So things, for instance, like promotion and tenure to match with those requirements.
And I think it's a good example of how it can't be just one thing. Like, you could have all the incentives in the world, but if leadership at your institution isn't going to support this, then the chances of getting researchers to buy in is pretty low. And I think this is a really great font of information. This is one of the ones that might be worth digging into if you find this interesting, because I think there are lessons to take away here for an institution to figure out what different key pieces their peers are finding useful to actually get researchers to use these different services that they're offering.
I agree completely. And I think the main point from kind of giving you all that rundown of each of those different questions is that the fact that you're getting the similar responses to those three different questions, even the two, like two are relatively similar, but then the barriers is kind of the opposite of that. The fact that those are such similar results is, at least in my mind, a relatively strong point to suggest these are some of the things to focus on if you're trying to build out a data stewardship service and engage with your researchers.
And speaking of things to focus on and engaging with their researchers, my last little takeaway that I wanted to highlight actually goes and looks at a little bit of what works in terms of engagement. So one of the questions that they asked on the survey was about successful approaches that the different services had used to engage with research data producers. Obviously, this was not like the main point of the survey, since they were looking more at, you know, institutional environment, but I like that they included it because I think it was a good data gathering opportunity. And like their other open-ended questions, they had a couple of themes that rose to the top. Five specifically, once they did their thematic analysis on the data. And those were support for data production, skills development, recognition of good practice, data tools provision, and effective communication. So those were the five that were the successful approaches that the different services had used. Now, because it was thematic, they didn't specify which of these themes got the most responses, because there's 46 responses. That was like the total for this particular question. Although I'm sure that's something that you could dig into if you looked up the raw data. I'll be honest, the recognition of good practice is not something I expected to see on there. The others were pretty, I don't want to say like expected, but that seems very much in line with what literature and discussion with peers shows as working well. But the recognition of good practice was a little bit of surprise to me. And the three types of responses that fell under this umbrella were things like offering badges, recruiting researchers as data champions, and building reputation for the utility of their service. You know, we've actually talked about doing badges both at PNNL and I know amongst other people talking about doing badges at their institution, but we haven't actually implemented them. And I haven't worked at a place that's had badges. Brianna, have you ever seen anybody do badges for data stuff?
So I haven't seen the badges necessarily for data stuff, but we heavily use badges at Penn State for things like informational literacy. And it's utilized in many of our kind of introductory general education courses for students to go through. So I do think there's an opportunity here. I know my unit has talked a lot about, could there be a good way to create a data literacy badge and have that be something that brings incentive? Going between that and whether it's better just have kind of like a graduate level course is kind of where we've left things off.
That is true, because it's always like, okay, how do you break down the badges? As I was saying, like, I've never worked at a place. I remembered Wyoming for their makerspace, they did badges, but that was more like, congratulations, you are now able and allowed to use like the CNC machine and you've taken the safety courses. And less so like, I'm trying to think what a badge for data would be. Like, you've published your data under a visible DOI or something like that?
I would think so. I know for our informational literacy, one of them is called the Savvy Searcher. So it's around getting like information from the libraries and how to use search tools appropriately. So I could see that being one, or maybe it's understanding data repositories or something.
Well, hey, if any of our listeners, we're not jumping to the questions for our listeners, but if any of you out there are using badges for data services or data literacy, get in touch. We'd love to hear about what it looks like. Maybe even talk to you on the show. Getting back to that, to the engagement bit, I also like the recruitment piece in there as a method in and of itself. Personally, I know that's a side effect of providing good service. We rely a lot on word of mouth for like, hey, like I worked with the library and they were really helpful and maybe you should go talk to them too. But I'm wondering if like being more intentional about recruiting, not in like an overwhelming kind of way, but just being more intentional when those opportunities arise could have an impact in how I manage to get people to use our services.
I think that's definitely true. I know that's something we talk a lot about, or have been talking a lot about recently in our unit, is how can we make sure that users are aware that these services exist, as well as kind of potentially even like brand the services so they have an understanding of like what that looks like, what to expect, how does it, what's the feel of it. And part of that is because we've gotten feedback that people don't, one, initially expect these services to be in libraries. And so they're unaware of our services or the extent to which we can help them.
And I know there's a couple of universities, and I want to say it was the Netherlands that had the data champions, the program that went over really well. So there is a lot of evidence that that stuff works. And it's great to, you know, see it reinforced even more with the data.
Yes. And speaking of the data, we just want to highlight again, because I think it's a really important and interesting point of this survey, is that they have provided openly their cleaned and anonymized underlying data. We will link to that in the show notes. And they even say in their concluding point, we have not looked in detail at every aspect of this data that we can, and we want others to find interesting points in it. So this could be a really useful data set if you're interested in exploring more, either the roles of data stewardship, how they vary across organizational or domain specificity, and digging into service offerings and providings and engagement.
Yep. And even if you don't want to read all 50 pages, which is understandable, I would say Brianna and I both highly recommend at least going to read the executive summary for this report, because they really take down and distill the major takeaways from the data. So helpful if you are trying to decide if you want to dive more into the data.
Exactly. So Shannon, should we move to our questions for our listeners?
I think we can.
So first question for you all is, do you, kind of looking at that data, do you see ways to extrapolate or utilize this data to better understand data stewardship roles or the development of data stewardship services?
And our second question, do you see your institution reflected in this survey and the way your stewardship services are offered? Is it something that you're like, yes, I do believe that we're represented here, or you're like, man, I wish I had replied to this survey when it came around? Well, that's all the time we have for today, folks. Thanks for joining Brianna and I as we dove into this multi-page report and came out with quite a lot of interesting nuggets and probably more to find. So we hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you next time on IDEA.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode of IDEA.
You can find the resources from today's show in the show notes.
Our theme music is by Scott Holmes. And a big thanks to the Research Data Alliance Interest Group, Engaging Researchers with Data, for supporting our work.
If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.